All right, so we're continuing in Mark chapter 4. We're going to finish up chapter 4 today. Thanks to Thad for covering last week while I was enjoying the winter weather in Chicago. I expected when I left that, you know, they have so much lake effect weather up there that I was going to go up there, and before I got there, it would be a lot of snow. They didn't have any snow, which surprised me, but before I left, they corrected that. Not with mountains of it, but we had our winter day up there. But we're in Mark chapter 4, and today we're going to cover verse 35 through the end of the chapter. Now, to get things set up for us, let's first go back and look at verse 1, because this chapter lines up with what's happening here. Verse 1 says, he began to teach again by the sea. And he had this large crowd gathered to him. He got into a boat and sat down, and the whole crowd was by the sea on the land. And then we go through the teaching that he does there, and it's a parable of the seeds and the sower. And then he stops and explains that to the way the words here are, to the 12 and more. So there's some other people who are the inner circle followers, not just the big crowds. And then he continues to teach parables, and Thad wrapped up the last of the parables for us last week. And so now we are down to verse 35, and we conclude the day. So if somebody wants to read 35 through the end of the chapter, I would appreciate it.
That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There was also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him."
All right. So this is a fascinating account of one of Jesus' miracles with his followers. And so we're going to take a look at that and try to visualize being there for some of it. And so I'll bring some information in that maybe will help us. But verse 35 starts out on that day. So it looks like these events that we've been studying in chapter 4 occurred at approximately the same time. I mean, it's possible that there were multiple days, and so it just means the day that is going on when verse 34 concluded. I don't know. But most folks tend to think, you know, these things in the rest of the chapter are pretty much all at about the same period of the same day. So, because it says on that day, so that sounds like it's just one. But anyway, on that day, when evening came. Now, I really wish that this was a little bit more explicit, because I'm going to talk a little bit about what this experience would have been like in the dark, because this very well could mean into the nighttime, but also evening then could have been as early as 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so it's just not clear. We don't really know. Although many of the commentators will say, by the time this occurs, we're in the nighttime. I don't know. But anyway, we'll go over that and talk about it when we get there a little more. And so it says, he said to them. Well, that's pretty simple, straightforward language. We would know Jesus said to who. Well, he is Jesus, and he said to who? Well, based on what we see here in the story, it's probably more than the 12. It's probably that extra group, however big it was, 5 more people, 20 more people, we don't know, but there was another group of closer followers going with them that were involved in the events of the day that they saw. So Jesus said, let's go over to the other side. So the other side of what? Well, where are we?
On the Sea of Galilee.
On the Sea of Galilee, probably near Capernaum. And Capernaum was where on the Sea of Galilee? North, south, east, west, where? Northwest side of the sea. And if we were looking at it today, the Sea of Galilee looks something like this. And it's really deep here, and it just keeps getting more shallow, although it never gets really shallow, and Capernaum is like right over here. If we were to look at that today, this side of the lake is Syria, and quite probably was in that era as well. Don't quite know where all the borders ran exactly, but when he's going over to the other side, it's very likely no longer under the province at that time of Israel. May have been, because at times it was included that part, at times it didn't. I don't know how the Romans had it divided up when they were running the game. But, so Jesus initiated that, and he wanted to go to the other side. Why did he want to go to the other side?
Probably wanted to get away from the crowd.
Well, you know, we're guessing at anything we say, but in all probability, the crowd is not going to be following them once they get in the boats and go, are they? Many people say, you know, he often sought some refuge, some time to recharge his batteries. You can imagine how excruciatingly difficult it would be to go through what he'd been through, teaching people that were crowded to him up next to the water. What else were they doing besides just being there to be taught? They're dragging everybody that needed something to him. The demon-possessed and the people who needed some sort of physical healing. So, I mean, never a moment. We're told earlier that the crowds were so intense at times they couldn't even figure out how to get away enough that they could eat a meal. So, I mean, this wasn't easy work. And that's a pretty good guess. But I'll tell you, if we start looking at chapter 5, I don't think that's why he went. Because when he gets across the lake, he's going to run into a demoniac from Gennesaret, and there's quite a situation that occurs there. And so when we look at Jesus' ministry, you know, he generally knows what's coming next and why and what his plans are. So I don't think it makes much sense if you think about who Jesus is, the other things that have gone on in his ministry, that he's over here, he wants some rest, and he goes over there, and he doesn't get the rest that he thought he wanted because he has to deal with other ministry things. I just think he went because that's what was coming next, and he knew it, and that's where he needed to be. Now, I can't say that's the truth. I don't know, but it just seems a little bit out of character to think that he was going after a rest that didn't work out. But anyway, so he says, let's go over to the other side. And so that's what they're going to do. And so how do they do it? Well, who's when you're talking about being on the Sea of Galilee, had Jesus called some people that were very familiar with the Sea of Galilee? Yeah, we can look at James and John and Andrew and Peter and Andrew. There we go. Simon's the word I was getting confused about here for a second. We can look at them. What was their trade? They were fishermen. That's where they lived, was on the sea. I mean, they spent their days on the sea. So you can even see the transition occur. Verse 36. Leaving the crowd, they took him along with them. Who's they here? The disciples. And you can just bet, who's the guy leading the charge and giving the orders?
Peter.
Yes. You just can't even imagine it any other way, can you? Oh, and Peter, this is Peter's business. Both in two ways. One, it is his trade, but also the boats they're using. I mean, there's a very real possibility. Peter and his father and his brother owned that business on the lake. They're probably using Peter's boats, or maybe James's and John's boats. And there's even some speculation that some of the other apostles that we don't know much about may also have been fishermen from the lake. So anyway, there they are. And so they all get in the boat just as he was. So they took him, so there's some probably the 12, or at least Peter and some of the others, get in this boat with Jesus, and there were other boats with him. I don't know why. I mean, I'm embarrassingly old in my own estimation. I'm not that old, but I'm older than I ever thought I might be, I guess. And it took 62 years to read those other lines. I always visualize this as a single boat. No, there are multiple boats crossing the water. But Jesus is in one of the boats, and undoubtedly with the bulk of, if not all, of the 12. And certainly, I would say, just this is my own conjecture, with Peter. And so they're crossing the water. We can look over to Luke. We're not going to go turn to the other parallel passages of this. But the one there's a couple things we'll bring out. One is, in Luke, it makes it clear that they're not rowing, they're sailing. The Luke is the only one that uses this kind of a word, but the word Luke uses indicates sailboat and sailing rather than rowing. Now, their sailboats in that era would have included the ability to row in case there wasn't any wind, but if they could, they would sail. And many of the boats in that era could and did sail around when the winds were favorable for that. So let's talk about the Sea of Galilee a little bit. Some of this I think I've mentioned before, but some of this I know I haven't. It's the lowest altitude-wise freshwater lake in the world. Now, the sea, the Dead Sea is lower in elevation, but it's a salt sea. It's full of the minerals. But the Sea of Galilee is a freshwater lake. And in its deepest point, which is kind of up here, they may have even been crossing that deepest point, which is irrelevant to the story here. But in its deepest part, it pushes up on, in normal levels, about 150 foot deep. But the average depth is 84 feet, so it's a fairly deep lake. It's 33 miles around the shore, 13 miles long, 8.1 miles wide. It's about 60. I'm going to get this number wrong, so I'm not going to use the numbers, but I'll tell you this. I looked this up to try to get something to compare to. It's about six times as big as Lake Melbourne. Now, I'm pulling this information about Lake Melbourne off the internet. I don't know which pool level they're talking about, because you know, if you know about the core lakes, you got the floodplain, you got the normal level, you got, and the dimensions of the lake will change dramatically depending on what it is. But it's listed as about six times the size of Lake Melbourne. So we wouldn't call this a sea by any stretch. As a matter of fact, if you were to compare this, the Sea of Galilee, to any one of the Great Lakes, you'd be like, this is the drop. I mean, I started trying to get a comparison to say, you know, how many of the Sea of Galilee, it's just like, no. It would be more like this if you were looking at Lake Superior coming down. The Sea of Galilee would be something like that, okay? So it's just much smaller than we would call a sea. And as a matter of fact, today it's not called a sea. It is a lake, starts with a K, Kinneret, there it is. Today we call it Lake Kinneret. There is a town nearby called Kinneret. Oh, and that's not that we made it up in today's world. In the Old Testament at times it was called Lake Kinneret as well. And there's some other names for it. It's had a number of names based on what town, or even in one case when for a while there was a plain out there where people did a lot of agriculture, and they named it after that plain for a while. So it's had a lot of different names. But it's about 33 miles all around the shore, 13 miles long, 8.5 miles wide. It's primarily fed by the Jordan River, but there are also some hot springs that feed into the lake. And because of the variations in temperature that feed it, it's very stratified with regard to temperature in the lake. The deeper waters are extremely cold. The upper waters are warmer in the summertime. The lakes roll over, you know how that goes. So it can vary. But because of those temperature extremes of the water coming in, it's extremely stratified. And that also leads to this being one of the very most productive freshwater lakes in the world for providing commercial fish to feed the populace. As a matter of fact, in 1896, they recorded one fishing boat, and these aren't like ocean trawlers. This is fishing boats, like I'm going to describe to you in a minute. That one boat brought in 9,200 pounds of fish. So now you start thinking about that a minute. This lake is extremely prolific on the fishing, and it really is important. You know, that's why, you know, they think about a third of the protein provided for the land of Israel came out of the Sea of Galilee. So it's amazing what it did. Also, it provides the water for about half of the population of Israel today. As a matter of fact, they've become dependent on it enough that they're starting to reach the limits of the lake to provide that. So they're bringing over water from the Mediterranean Sea, desalinating it, and putting it into the lake in massive quantities. So there now has another source that's recently developed to keep the Sea of Galilee going. This sea is just really important to the region for water and still for food and everything else that's going on. It also has, and by the way, yeah, I said fed by the Jordan River. I think I covered all that. The other key thing about the Sea of Galilee is it's surrounded by mountains, ranging from 3,000 feet above sea level to about 6,000 feet above sea level, 50-something hundred, which creates a real problem because, you know, this lake's down about 700 feet below sea level, 682 feet below sea level. And so you get some fantastic weather patterns going. The most common time of the day to have all this happen is from noon to about 6 o'clock. Now, we're in when the evening came, so we're in this story a little bit outside of that time. But fierce winds are common in the afternoon there. And they come roaring down the mountain, and in the summertime, they'll get some storms out of that that just pop up instantly because of the air concentration and whatever's going on with the humidity over the lake. In the wintertime, it's worse because you've got the air that's coming down, the wind direction's changed, you've got cold air coming down, you've got the warm water that's warmer than the air, so it tends to bring more humidity in the environment. And you get all that mixed together, and you get some fantastic storms. And we're going to have one of these before we get done today. So here they are, headed to the other side, crossing this lake that was so much a part of several of those guys' lives, as well as the life of Israel. And they've headed across there. So verse 37 pops up. And we see, oh, let me give you some information about the boat. Interestingly, in the late 80s, there were some gentlemen who owned a fishing business on Lake Galilee that were very conscious of the history. You know, this is a big deal. It's been a big deal in this part of the world forever. And they really wanted to find some artifactual kind of things to go along with that. So they were always on a sharp lookout for various things from the fishing trade on the lake. They really wanted to find a boat. And sure enough, in the 80s, they had a bad, bad drought. The lake level went down, and they found a fishing boat. Everything about it dated it to somewhere between 100 BC and about 50 AD. So this is right out of the time period. Archaeologically, they said that's the time it was. I'm not a big fan of carbon dating in that, but the carbon dating said that. I mean, everything about it lined up. And so this boat was recovered. There wasn't a lot there. You can imagine this boat's been underwater for 2 millennia, okay, about. There's pictures of it on the internet. If you want to go look, just do a little Googling, and you'll find it in a heartbeat. And the pictures show the planking on the boat was pretty much still there. The rib structure on the boat was still there. They were able to take measurements, and they said it was about 27 feet long. So if any of you have been out fishing and know boats, that's not huge. It's a lot bigger than most of us take out for a fishing boat, but not that much bigger. 7.5 feet wide, which isn't very wide compared to what most of us would use for a fishing boat. 4.3 feet high. By that they mean the sides of the boat from the keel to the top of the sides were about, was at the maximum 4.3. That part gets a little hard to measure because of the deterioration. So it's got a little bit of size to it. They estimate that you could put 15 to 20 people in it. I think that's a little optimistic from what boats I've been on. But yeah, it's 4.5 foot tall side. So maybe, I don't know. I think you got 20 on there, people are going, I'll take the later boat. You guys go ahead. But anyway, so you can put a number of people on it. And so you can imagine the kind of a structure that these guys are headed across the lake on, a sailboat, a little less than 30 feet long probably. And so, I missed a piece here. In verse 36 it says, and I'm not sure of the significance of it, it says, they took him along in the boat just as he was. And I think we could say, well, he didn't go to town and freshen up. He didn't get a bite to eat. You know, apparently, he said, let's go. And they went, all right, and just loaded him up. And away they went. Verse 37, and there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat, so much so that the boat was already filling up. And so what you've got going on here, the words that Luke uses here, we're not trying to say it was a hurricane, but you would use the same words for a hurricane. Now, it really means a fierce wind, but this is strong language about this wind. This is a wind. This is significant. They said when the winds blow that 5 foot swells are not at all uncommon on this lake. So you can imagine if you're in the low part, you know, the water, this is significant, breaking over the bow. And so here they are, these waves are coming in the boat with them. They're taking on a lot of water. And I haven't been in a boat with a lot of water on it, but I've been in a boat with a little bit of water in it. And everything changes in life. It operates differently. It sets lower in the water. It's something that's going to happen more quickly if you're going to swamp the boat. I mean, you put, in our case, this last summer, I think we probably had, probably 10 or so inches of water in the boat for a little while because of some rougher water. And now the boat's setting 10 inches lower, right? If you understand the physics, you know it has to displace its weight in water. Well, you just lowered the boat 10 inches in the water, and what looked like a high-sided boat earlier doesn't look quite so high-sided. Now, we were never in any doubt about our safety or anything, but you have to think differently. And so here these guys begin to think very differently. Here's these waves coming over the boat. It's taking on water, and it's filling up. So this isn't just it has some water in it. It has some water in it, and it's getting more water in it, and it's filling up. When you fill the boat up, that's just a short, small step from swimming, and you probably don't want to swim in really heavy water out there. Now, just to finish this story out and keep the story going, Jesus himself was in the stern asleep on the cushion. Now, if you can imagine a fierce wind, and even in a 27-foot boat, which is bigger than most of us in here personally would use, but you're going to be, is this going to be a smooth ride? No, you're getting tossed around. It's probably even difficult. I don't know if they have the sails up at this point or if they dropped the sails and now they're trying to keep the boat going with some oars and keep it properly aligned, but they're probably having a tough time just keeping this boat in the right direction so that the waves aren't just totally swamping them all at once. And Jesus is asleep on the cushion in the back, astern, back of the boat. So they woke him up. Now, I want to see if we can get in the picture here with this next question. So Jesus was asleep. If he was asleep and a normal human being, did he know what was going on? Yeah. Now he's asleep. If you were sleeping, do you know what's happening?
No.
No. So he doesn't know what's going on. So try to get the logic of this question. Teacher, Rabbi, do you not care we're perishing? And so it's pretty clear at this point, they are panicked. They have Because that's not a reasonable question. He didn't know they were perishing if he was a normal human, and that's a little bit how they're teaching it, treating him here, right? So don't you care we're about to die? I mean, so here, these are experienced fishermen. They've been on this lake before, and they think they're going to die. Now, I don't want to force on top of this the nighttime, but if you've ever been out at night on a boat, particularly if it's really dark, things feel different. About 20 years ago, I decided I wanted to fish all night at Melbourne. There was a point out there where they were catching fish, particularly at night. I'm going to go out and fish. And I went and looked up the moon chart, and I found out the moon was going to be full, be adequate. And I fortunately had a GPS on my boat, but I roared out there and I anchored. It was totally black. The moon didn't come up. And I was a little bit disgusted with myself over that to begin with. It was before the days of smartphones, so I couldn't look up and figure out what I did wrong. But as the night progressed, and there's a couple other boats anchored out there, and they have to have a little white light on, and we were off of Turkey Point, so you could see a few camper stuff, but we were far enough out. It just got so eerie you couldn't believe it. You could see the water next to you and whatever else, but just as time went on, at some point I said, I've had enough of this, I don't like it. I want to get away from this, so I fired my boat up and followed my GPS back, and of course at one point we went by, here's this log floating in the water, and I'm going, oh my goodness, what am I going to hit? But I'm just telling you, that's an eerie experience. Now add 5 foot waves to the eerie experience. This would really be something. I'll just finish the rest of the story. Moonrise was about 3 o'clock in the morning. That's what I did wrong. I didn't look at when it came up. It was that time of the year when it came up late in the morning. But anyway, this could have been just amazingly frightening. I mean, I think it's, to be fair to these men in the boat with Jesus, and we're not even talking about the other boats. They had to be going through the same thing, right? They didn't just magically avoid the storm. But it just had to be overwhelming. And so Jesus got up, and the first thing he did in verse 39 is he dealt with the issue. He rebuked the wind and said to the sea, hush, be still. All right? And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And if you think about that a minute, that by itself is supernatural, that it was perfectly calm. It doesn't say immediately, but in short order, okay? The wind stopped and the sea became calm. And Jesus then said to them, why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith? That is a monumental question in this story. In a way that ought to impact us very significantly as well. Because Jesus looked at them, when you read this, what do you think Jesus is communicating to these men?
You still don't believe I'm God.
You still don't believe I'm God?
It's not my time.
Okay, it's not my time.
Well, they're still, their main emphasis in their life is still the physical.
Yeah.
Which is valid for us too. But
valid for us too.
But still, you can carry it too far.
Well, you can carry it too far, but let's even just for fun, let's examine that just a little bit. Is this the way Jesus is supposed to die?
No.
Do they know that?
Nope.
No. I mean, Jesus hasn't given them a roadmap for the rest of his ministry yet. So Jesus is still somewhat dependent on the way things are going to come out. Not dependent in the sense that they're going to control him, but dependent in that events need to turn out the right way. But he hasn't voiced that to them. And so you've got these things going on here, but what about this? Do you still have no faith? I mean, that implies by now you should have more faith, right?
He's seen him heal all these people and do all these things, and they still don't get it.
Jesus has shown his godly power that could only come from God himself over what? What have we seen him show his power over?
Demons.
Demons?
Sickness.
And food?
Food, yeah.
Yeah, the food really hasn't happened yet here. In Mark.
Trailing with him, and he's provided for him. So
he's claimed the power over forgiveness of sins.
He's forgiven sins. So he has given them reason to believe and know this is God himself. Now, it still would be an interesting question that they weren't going to ask, and if I was there, I wouldn't even think of asking myself. But it would be an interesting question to have an answer from Jesus to, well, what did you expect us to do? I mean, what's our next step? We're out here in the boat doing like this, and the water's coming over the front. The boat's getting full. I mean, we have a short amount of time and very few options. What did you think we were going to do? And I kind of have a little bit of a conclusion, but I don't know that I'm right. I would hesitate greatly to say I know the mind of Christ here. But look back at the question. Do you not care that we're going to die? When you look at that question, it might very well be, and this is just a might, what Jesus expected was to be woke up and go, hey, Jesus, we got a problem here. Can you help us out? I mean, look, everybody else is coming to Jesus with their problem. Different kind of problem. But my relative is sick. I'm sick. I have a demon. This person has a demon. Sight restored. Whatever. Go down through the list. Jesus has been a problem solver for a lot of people. But they're kind of accusatory in the question, aren't they? As well as believing that, they're about to die to some extent. And so Jesus looks at them and goes, do you still not have any faith? I think he probably expected to be awakened. As a matter of fact, how many things do you think really happened in Jesus' ministry that were not pre-planned?
None.
I think that's probably a fair estimate. And so Jesus probably curls up in the back of the boat, and if he has a sense of humor about these things, probably says, this is going to be an interesting night. And just waits it out. I don't know that, and I don't want to make light of it, but I would guess that Jesus probably knew what was coming.
Say, Rick.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about food, wasn't it earlier when he told, when they weren't catching anything, and he told them to cast their net on the other side?
Yeah, he's done that already back when he called them.
Wasn't that kind of what made some of them give up their trade? And
they recognized the power of God. To be fair to these folks, this is the first time Jesus has exercised his dominion over the elements. He has interjected himself into the lives of the living people. And you could say, well, there was an example back at the Canaanite wedding where he turned water into wine. But that's a really different thing than being in the midst of a storm and instantly the storm shuts off.
All of this also could be like just an example. I mean, just...
Oh, I think it was a very intentional example for them.
Right.
And we're gonna get into why that's important in a little bit. Somebody else said something. Yes, sir.
What do you think that they were... expecting to happen? If they don't know, or they haven't grasped at this point that he has power over the waves, I mean, if nobody has power over the waves, then they're all dead. I mean, there's really nothing that can happen, right?
You know, there's a couple of extremes here that this could be. One is they expect him to have already done something. Why are you letting us get up to the point we're about to die? That would be one extreme. The other one is, well, you know, there are 11 of us, and the 11 of us are failing at saving the boat, or 12, or whatever the number is. Would you please lend your effort to bailing? I mean, that would be the other extreme. At least it's one more and to help try to get the water on the right side of the boat. And so my estimation is they were just exasperated, and they expressed their exasperation.
Is the Greek clear enough? Is Jesus included in that we? We're going to die.
There's no way to know for sure. I mean, it's just a plural we.
Right.
So it isn't just one of them. It's I would say just based on normal language context, they're including Jesus, that they think he's going to be a part of that. That somehow they've gotten off on this trip across the Sea of Galilee, and they're not going to reach the other side.
Well, they're really no different than we are, because our ultimate goal as a Christian is to learn to rely on God. And he promised us eternal life after death, not on earth. So,
go over to Psalm 10:1. This is not a thing that is outside the expression of people through history that have been in the kingdom of God, particularly in this case, the Jews. Let's read. You could keep reading, but let's just read 1 and 2, just to get the flavor for what's being said here. If you got it, go ahead. Psalm 10, 1 and 2.
Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In arrogance and wicked, hotly pursuit the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised.
Okay, and it keeps going. It keeps talking about the wicked pursue the righteous, and bad people do bad things, and bad things happen to, quote, good people. It's kind of the theme of this. So why do you stand off and let this happen, God? Have we ever heard anything like that in our lives? I mean, just think of the tragedies that have happened. One of the tsunamis, we were over there helping clean up, and people were going, well, why would God let this happen? You know, if God is able to take care of things, what's the deal? And many people would say, I can't believe in a God that would let this happen. Our own 9/11 event back in the year 2001, people were asking the question, where was God on 9/11? Right where he always is. But many people would look at that and say, if God is love and God is righteous and God is just, why would he let, quote, these innocent people all die by these terrorists? And we've heard this same kind of thing around natural events. You hear the same kinds of things about at times, and I want to be very careful with this, because we ought to be tender-hearted to people that go through things. We ought to be tender-hearted to these guys. I mean, let's just get real. There isn't anybody in this room would have done any better. Maybe a lot worse. I don't know. I mean, you might go to a Jonah moment. Who's causing this trouble? I don't know. He's the one that said, let's go pitch him over the side. I don't know. You know? The range of reactions could be huge based on the kind of event you're going through. Brings out all kinds of responses. But being tender-hearted about it, when a child dies, you know, it's really easy to say, people that are touched by that, well, why would God let this happen in our family and to our friend and to whatever? I mean, this is not a new question. The events of life happen, and these events often have tragedy in them. There's also times that the events have euphoria in them, but we don't ask ourselves about, well, why was God so kind to me? I sure didn't deserve that. But boy, when the bad things happen, this stuff kind of comes out. And people who are followers along, I don't know if you want to say they're born again, but some of these folks will actually even go, I'm done with Christianity, or I'm done with the faith. I used to believe in God, but I don't anymore. If this can happen, there can't be a God in the universe. So this is not a new question or an unusual question. It might be unusual to say, do you care we're not about to die in the middle of a lake? Because that doesn't happen so often. But in the big scheme of things, it's similar to what goes on many, many times in life. And so Jesus here shows them, all right, you've seen my power. You still don't have enough faith to expect the right thing here. And he shows them his power, and he stills the waters. This is an unnatural event. Let's go back over to Psalms again. Chapter 65, verses 5 through 8.
You answer us in righteousness with all-inspiring works, God of our salvation, the hope of all the ends of the earth and of the distant sea. You establish the mountains by your power. You are robed with strength. You silence the roar of the seas, the roar of their waves, and the tumult of the nations. Those who live far away are awed by your signs. You make east and west shout for joy.
You see the connection that's made there about God himself in the Psalms? You made it all. You made the mountains. You made what's here. And not only did you make it, you control it. You calm the seas. Interesting thing for the psalmist to be saying when we look at what's going on over here with these gentlemen. Literally the same example. The Creator can and does calm the seas. Another one, go over to Psalm 89. We're going to read verses 8 and 9.
O Lord God of hosts, who is mighty like you, O Lord? Your faithfulness also surrounds you. You rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them.
Another example where the people look at God taking care of the mighty seas and the frightening thing. I have seen coastlines several times in my life, not many, but a few. My wife hadn't until we made a trip to, I'm going to say Southern California, but it was the middle part of the state, actually. When I was traveling for the company, she went along on a trip to San Luis Obispo. And we went out to the ocean there and watched the waves coming for a while. And I was kind of surprised because she's not... I mean, she does things around the water, not frightened by water, gets out on the boat with me, and I do stupid things sometimes. And she just does it, and it's fine. But she actually, for a little while, had a period of time when the massiveness of the ocean caused a little bit of fear with her. And, you know, the ocean is a frightening place if you're not in the right situation. And they clearly are not in the right situation here, but they've picked in this two psalmist examples. One of the very frightening situations is when the sea is turning on you and they say it's God that gives us safety back. And so that to me was very interesting. Go over to John chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. John would have been here, right? John starts his book like a good writer would, with giving you a little bit of an insight into where he's going with his discussion of Jesus. Now, Mark does the same thing, but Mark emphasizes that this is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So Mark says, I'm going to give you the good news, and he starts giving it to us. John is more inclined to tell us more about the personality of Jesus and the person of Jesus than Mark is. And so he talks about the person of Jesus. And so he begins with a really high point, a clear discussion about what he came to do, know Jesus to be. Let's read John 1, 1 through 4.
In the beginning was the Word, and that Word was with God, and that Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by it, and without it was made nothing that was made. It was the life, and that life was the light of men.
What's Jesus' role in creation? Nothing was made that Jesus wasn't a part of. What's really, in a way, new information out of this event that we see described in Mark? The new information is, I'm also creator. I rule over the creation itself. I'm not just here to deal with people's lives and their sin and everything else. The extent of Jesus' power includes, as the creator, he can tell the whole creation, even the elemental parts, what to do. He spoke it into existence, and he can speak it into any condition he wants. To be fair to these guys, this is the first time they see him speak to the creation. And he does. And John got the point. I don't know if this is where he got it or where he got it, but I don't know if he thought about this event, but this is an event that says that Jesus is not only fully powerful as God over the things that affect mankind, including his sin, he's fully in power over the very creation itself and the way that it's behaving.
He uses John as an example, and John ends up getting his head cut off.
Oh, no. No. Not this John. Oh, you, when you...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
different Johns.
Yeah, different John.
Different John. Okay. Different. Hebrews 1, 1 through 3. Whoops, that's not Hebrews. Hebrews 1, 1 through 3.
God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high.
There's two very, not necessarily new, but interesting points that are made about Jesus with relationship to the creation. One is, you know, when we look at the book of Genesis, we see the plural words in there, and we say, this is the Trinity, God and Jesus right there. But the words here in Hebrews are a little different. If you look at this, it doesn't mean they weren't all there and didn't all participate in creation in terms of all aspects of the Trinity, but it says that through whom he also made the world. It really put Jesus in a primary place in creation. Wasn't just a co-participant, but was the creating agent. And then it goes on to say that he upholds all things by the word of his power. He's holding it all together for us as we stand here, sit here today. And he was holding it all together for them when they were rocking in that boat on the winds. And he just simply said, stop it. And it was done. Because he is the power. Even when he was walking around here on earth, he was a power that holds this creation together. Colossians 1, 16 and 17. Then we're going to move on. Colossians 1, 16 and 17.
For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together.
Very similar words to what we read over in Hebrews, isn't it? Here it says it was the things were created by him and for him. This creation belongs to Jesus, according to these words. And he keeps it all together for us. So, they're discovering, this is their first step in discovery, I think, about Jesus' role as creator and his dominion over the creation itself. They really get to see it in spades. He lets them walk right up to the point they think this creation and a storm that happens in this creation is going to bring about their death. And he clearly shows them they have absolutely nothing to fear, right? Then let's read the last verse of Mark. Mark 4, whatever that last verse is, I'm not looking at it. Is it 35? No, yeah, 35. Nope, wrong chapter. Chapter 4. Verse 41. So the storm's over. And what happens? Verse 41, they became very much afraid. They were more scared after the storm's over by these words. These are such strong words. It's clear that their fears, I don't want to say they didn't go away because their fear of the storm went away. But now they're more afraid of what's in the boat rather than what's out of the boat. They were very much afraid and said to one another. Now, when I try to visualize these events to help teach them, and I run into trouble visualizing this one because is Jesus back on the cushion sleeping again? Is he standing close by? Are they whispering over? Off to the side? I don't know. But you know that you can know from this fear and the nature of it, you can't visualize this any other way than these guys are sobered, I think is the right word. They're like, and they're going to be very careful what they do and say. They're going to be quiet in their demeanor. But they still say to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? They get it. Now, they don't get it in a comfortable way. But they get that their image of who Jesus was way off. And now that they understand more about who Jesus is, it's like, we don't know this guy. What are we dealing with here? They are not comfortable with the outcome of this event. Not that they would rather be swimming in the water. They're happy about that, I'm sure. But now they have some new information to deal with, and it is very disconcerting. And this is not an unusual reaction to be having the realization of the presence of God in your midst. Go over to Judges chapter 13. This is an interesting story, I thought, to go to illustrate this. I ran across this almost by accident when I was looking for the right examples about men's reaction when they understand that God is in their midst. In Judges 13, it's the beginning of the story of Samson. We're not going to read all of chapter 13, but we're going to read verses 2 and 3, where we get introduced to Samson's father, Manoah. And there are some interactions we're going to skip just for sake of time, because you'll get the gist of it just by reading 2 and 3. And then we're going to go down to the end of the story of the interactions about Samson and read verses 21 through 23. So Judges 13, 2 and 3, and then skip down and read 21 through 23. And if you've got that, I'll appreciate it if you read it.
There was a certain man of Zorah of the tribe of the Danites, or Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, behold, you are barren and have not borne children, but you shall conceive and bear a son.
Okay, now what Barry's going to skip is the interaction between Manoah and the angels, God himself as represented by the angels and so on. And so now just get down and read Barry and read 21 through 23.
The angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and to his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die, for we have seen God. But his wife said to him, if the Lord had meant to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering at our hands, or shown us all of these things, or now announced to us such things as these.
Yeah, so here's Manoah interacting with what he perceives to be an angel most of the way through. And there's some discussion about this child and what's going to happen, and has to do some convincing and whatever. And they offer some sacrifices to this angel, or in the presence of this angel. And then the angel disappears, and Manoah realizes that wasn't an angel, that was God himself. And what's Manoah's reaction? We're going to die. I mean, that realization is not uncommon when people get into the presence and understanding of who God is. Go over to Isaiah 6, 1 through 5. This is used a lot, but it's really a hard passage to beat in understanding what it's like to be in the presence of God. And so many times when somebody's in the presence of God, the scripture will say, and he fell down like a dead man. So, you know, that's another reaction, but I chose these two to talk about it. Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 5.
In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, Holy, 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 is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. Then I said, Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.
You know, most people who are lacking in understanding of the majesty of God, it would be such a privilege to meet God face to face. I could get my questions answered. I could know for sure what's what. Meeting God face to face, outside of doing it at the time of glorification, when we are translated to heaven, either through the rapture, Christ's return, or death, is not a privilege. There isn't anybody in the scriptures, save Moses, who said, I want the privilege of being face to face with God, when it was a real possibility. And Moses had the audacity to ask for it, and God said, you really don't want that. But I'll give you a glimpse of my lesser parts, of my hinder parts, of kind of really, might even mean my shadow. And so here is Moses being the exception, but most everybody else, when they come face to face with God, they're like Isaiah was. Literally, that word means I am undone. I'm taken apart and can't be put back together. The spiritual Humpty Dumpty story, in a way. This ruins me because I'm not fit to be in the presence of God. I don't even know anybody that I associate with that's fit to be in the presence of God. I am condemned by my associations. I'm condemned by my own lips. I'm condemned. And of course, that is dealt with further along in this story, where he is cleansed from his unclean lips. And so here are these apostles of some mix in the boat with Jesus. Now, we don't know what goes on in the other surrounding boats exactly. I'm sure they were equally awed, like, what happened? But all of a sudden they realize that the magnitude of the being in the boat with them is so many times over what they thought, and they are afraid of it for good reason. A man with that kind of power, God with that kind of power, in the presence of themselves in that boat, was not a comfortable thing. It brings with that massive responsibility, massive accountability, massive transparency. Nothing hidden will remain hidden in the presence of God. God knows you now, but it becomes clear to you how much God knows you when this kind of a thing occurred. So if we back up and say all of Jesus' ministry has a purpose behind it, what's Jesus' purpose in revealing this to these men at this point? Yes, sir?
Well, I sort of look at it today. I've read a lot of stuff about how vicious young people are. And you figure they're taught 6 to 8 hours a day, that they're their own saviors, that society is going to give them all they want and all that kind of stuff. And then they look at society and they say, man, if somebody's feeding me a line. And rather than have that, if they had a sovereign God, an idea of a sovereign God who had all accountability, it's just going to change the spiritual aspect.
And I think you're right about today, but before I apply it today, and I need to keep it moving because we're just on the other end of this time business, but why do you think to them they needed to have this? And I will tell you that... Go ahead.
I think that, you know, they recognize him as teacher, but they haven't fully understood he's really God.
He's not. That's half of it, or maybe 90% of it. But to make it whole, and he will exercise that creative power on their behalf as they're ministering for him. Think about what's ahead of them. He's going to send them out later on in the book of Mark, community by community. Go in, minister, stay in the first place you say, don't take anything with you, and if they don't receive you, shake the dust off your feet and go to the next town. And before we're done, Jesus is going to be crucified in their midst. And they're all going to run, of course. They've got some scary times ahead. Every one of those 12, except the Apostle John, according to tradition, and some of it's recorded in Scripture, is going to be called to lay their life on the line and lose it for Christ. They're going to be accused, persecuted, they're going to be whipped. All of these things are going to happen, and they need to know that Jesus Christ, through his power as creator, is going to take care of them. Yes, they will go through bad things, but they'll do so with the power of Christ still with them at every turn. They need to never have fear. If it happens, it's because God intended to allow it to happen. And they need that confidence. Now, they won't really get that confidence until the day of Pentecost, right? How do we apply that to our lives? What tragedy has come upon us or our people, or our nation, us individually, that was a sign that God was losing control over the direction of this world? Absolutely nothing. If he can control the wind, he can control everything. We look at the politics and we don't like it, and we shouldn't like it. But it doesn't mean that God has lost control of this world. There is nothing outside of God's control. I mean, these guys thought they were victims of the wind. Jesus stood up and said, no, you are never a victim. Where is your faith? You don't get it yet. I run it all. There's a lot we can't explain. There's a lot that hurts. And Jesus cried with hurting people. It's not bad to hurt. But out of it all, we need to know that God is working his plan. And whatever we're called upon to do, we need not fear the outcome, even if it means a death like Jesus had. Questions? Comments? All right, let's close with a word of prayer. Father, thank you for revealing your power to these men and doing it in such a way that it can be recorded here and we can see your power. Lord, forgive us. We so often think we are victims of the world around us, victims of our own foolish decisions, victims, victims, victims. Lord, we trust you out of your sovereignty to lead us not only into the truth, but into the path of ministry and service and life that you want for us. Lord, we also know that out of that, you also called us to put our minds not on the flesh, but on the Spirit, so that we would do the things of the Spirit and not the things of the flesh. Lord, let us never think we are victims. But instead, Lord, let us seek you day by day, minute by minute, down to the very second, seek your face, seek your direction, and then have faith that you are taking us in the place you want us to be. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.